Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. This is Chris. And this week, I'm going to cover some EC stories. We had some requests to go back and do some more EC stuff. So I'm going to be doing two stories this week from Haunt of Fear number 19, which is from May of 1953. I picked this one after doing a search of some of the more gruesome EC stories, the ones that called the most attention and in some way contributed to the creation of the Comics Code. Foul Play was on this list, and based on some of the images from the final panels, I had to check this story out. So when I tracked down the issue, I was intrigued by the cover, which features an executioner with a double-bladed axe about to chop two people's heads off. So I had to see what that was about, which led to my also reading the other story that I'm going to cover, Doubleheader. So we've covered the creators involved with EC in the past, but just a very, very brief recap. We've got Al Feldstein, who was a writer and artist for EC, as well as being the editor. After Harvey Kurtzman left Mad Magazine in 1956, Feldstein ended up taking over, and he ran Mad Magazine until 1984. Jack Kamen was one of the most prolific artists for EC. He came from the Eisner and Iger studio. He later went on to work on the film Creepshow, and also did illustrations for the patent for the Segway, which was created by one of his sons. And Jack Davis was a freelancer who worked on seemingly all the EC titles. The final panels I mentioned from the story Foul Play were featured in Seduction of the Innocent, and he was one of the first artists on Mad, working on most of the first 30 issues. So if you're interested in more information about EC and about these creators, we've covered EC in depth in episodes 11, 21, 34, and 45, and those are covering things from not just the horror aspects, but also the sci-fi and the war stories. And we've also covered EC numerous times through the mini episodes. So on with the first story, Doubleheader, with the art by Jack Kamen and script by Al Feldstein. So we open, and it's one of the old witch's grim fairy tales. The old witch says, "Hee-hee, here's another of my infantile insanities, another childish chiller, another nursery nauseator. I call this foul fable Doubleheader." So, we open on the courtyard of a castle where an executioner is about to behead two people. We're told that once upon a time there was a lonely king who, despite being surrounded by women, was lonely because he'd never fallen in love, and therefore had no queen. The women of the court, Marie, Yvonne, and Suzette, would try to flirt, but the king had none of it. One day, though, the king sat bolt upright, for he had seen the most beautiful woman in the world, the maid. He called to have her brought to him, and then demanded they be left alone. The women of the court were not pleased. The king shared his feelings with the woman, Sylvia, and asked her to be his queen, to which she consented. They were married, and the women of the court continued their hatred, doubting the love would last. But it did, and with each day, the king grew more in love with his queen. He just wished he could be young again, so she may fall in love with him the way that he fell for her. One night, Sylvia went walking and came upon Cedric, a man she once loved. Cedric, captain of the royal guard, questioned her decision to marry King Irving. She said she could not turn down the offer of a kingdom, but Cedric advanced, asking if she didn't need to feel love herself and pulled her into an embrace, kissing her deeply. From above, Marie was watching. She told Yvonne, and the next night they waited for the Queen and Cedric to have another rendezvous. Yvonne heard the encounter, and she and Marie approached Suzette, who decided to tell the king. The king was heartbroken. He called a guard to summon both parties before him, as the women watched on, speculating what would happen. The king told Sylvia that he understood what she had done, but that he must order the beheading of both her and Cedric. The women watched with glee as the queen and her lover were marched away, figuring one of them were destined to be queen. The king sobbed, saying he'd forgive Sylvia if he could. The women swooped in, but the king shot them a fiery glare. And as the axeman sharpened his blade, a cry rang out from the throne room. The crowd gathered in the courtyard for the executions. The king appeared and beckoned out the two to be executed. The axeman chopped once, removing Cedric's head, and then again, and Sylvia was no more. The king retreated from the crowd, tears streaming down his face. In the castle, the three ladies of the court writhed in pain, one covering her eyes, as they'd been torn out for what she'd seen, one covering her ears, that had been burned off with a poker for what she'd heard, and one covering her mouth, now missing a tongue, for what she had said to the king. So I enjoyed the story. I was a little disappointed that the axeman did not end up using the double-bladed axe from the cover, but that's really neither here nor there. I mean, it's just something cool on the cover. I thought this was an interesting turn. Something that I enjoy about these stories, and something that drew me to the HBO Tales from the Crypt series too, was that there's a certain heart to these stories, and there's a certain level of humanity. It's not just for the sake of telling a gruesome, terrible story. In this story in particular, you can really feel that just how bad the king feels when he's sobbing after finding out that Queen Sylvia has been seeing Cedric. You can really tell the way that it's drawn that he is really heartbroken. He's so sad about this, and he's crying out to himself that he would forgive everything if he could, but because he's the king, he knows that he can't do that. He has to lead by example. It is very sad, and so they've set up these the women of the court who you know that they are up to no good, and yet they're not doing anything terrible. They're just gossiping, and you know, but even still, you want something to happen, and so when something does happen in the end, you feel a little better. I don't know if better is the right word, but you know, it's a nice little twist ending that I did not see coming. I really enjoyed this. The art, of course, I'm probably not going to say too much about the art for the next story, but because the art in both these stories is top-notch. You have two of the best DC artists, in my opinion, working on these stories, and it's all scripted by Feldstein, so there's really not much to say in the way of that. It's all pretty top notch. The some little inconsistencies in these stories are really just that. They're small inconsistencies that, you know, it's really not even worth bringing up. So yeah, really enjoyed that story. The cover really lured me in, and I really felt like it paid off. You know, sometimes I know that the covers don't necessarily have to line up and whatever, it's just to sell the book. But yeah, no, I thought this paid off really well. And also while the beheadings with the double-bladed axe, that is such a great image, and I'm going to use that as the teaser image or on the website, but really that is not even the big reveal in the story, so I really appreciated that. So yeah, great story. So moving on to Foul Play, with art by Jack Davis and the script by Al Feldstein. We've got our host, the Crypt Keeper, here. So it's midnight on the eve of Central City's Bush League baseball park's opening. And in the dimly lit field, men all stand in their positions, waiting for the umpire. As moonlight spills across the field, the call to action is shouted, "Play ball." But we go back to the final days of the previous season's pennant race at Bayville's baseball park. Bayville's pitcher strode to the plate as Central's batter, Herbie, was cheered on. Central City was up by one in the ninth in the final game of the playoffs. The batter stepped into the pitch and was caught on the elbow, and the ump told him to take a base as the catcher roared with anger. Central's lead man came to the plate with two outs. As Philly, Bayville's pitcher, wound up, Herbie took off for second. Philly got the ball to second in plenty of time, but Herbie slid in, spikes high. He was out, and Jerry, Bayville's second baseman, was down with a sliced open calf. Bayville chastised Herbie for what he did, but he took no fault for it, just saying, you know, it's part of the game. The first base coach questioned Herbie for taking off without a sign, but he brushed it off, sure that victory was in sight. The umpire yelled to play ball, and Central City took the field as Jerry was taped and bandaged. First batter hit a grounder and was out, as Jerry, the fourth in the lineup, began to sweat. Second batter up, pop fly to right, making two outs. Jerry began looking even worse for wear as the third batter entered the box. With a hit to deep left field, Bayville got a runner on second, and it was Jerry's turn at bat. The team cheered him on as he grabbed at a bat, dizzy and glassy-eyed. He missed the first pitch entirely. A slow second pitch came in, but Jerry couldn't focus and swung wildly, missing it too, making two strikes. As the third pitch hurtled across the plate and the ump called strike three, Jerry fell to the ground dead. Back in the locker room, the doctor looked Jerry over and decided the cause of death was poison. The team quickly sorted that Herbie from Central City was the culprit, as Jerry was the ringer and surely would have secured them the game. Bayville entered the away team locker room and found the locker Herbie used. The doc found Herbie's cleats and found traces of poison still on them. They debated calling the cops, but then decided to handle things their own way. So we get a bit of exposition here from the Crypt Keeper. Yes, fiends. Herbie Satin had so wanted to win the pennant, not for Central City, but for his own fat ego, that at the beginning of the ninth, while his team was at bat, he'd painted his spikes with the fast-acting poison. He'd carried the poison with him for just such an occasion. Getting hit with the pitch was easy. The slide, easier, and the job was done. And all last winter, Herbie thought he'd gotten away with it. He pitched his team to victory and the pennant. He'd been declared a hero. Soon, it would be the big leagues for him. Soon, he'd be famous. He'd have a name. A name immortalized in the annals of baseball. That's why, on the day before opening day, when the letter arrived, he fell for the invitation. So after an off-season of feeling like a hero, a letter arrives for Herbie about a plaque to be erected the night before the season opener at Central Cities Park. It instructed him to be there at 11 p.m. to decide on wording and placement. When he arrived, though, he was surprised to find the Bayville team waiting with their doctor. So then we cut to the panels that I was talking about. And the page reads, "So now you know, fiends. Now you know why there's a ball game being played in the moonlight at midnight in the deserted Central City ballpark. Look closely. See this strange baseball game. See the long strings of pulpy intestines that mark the baselines. See the two lungs and the liver that indicate the bases. The heart that is home plate. See Doc White bend and whisk the heart with the mangy scalp, yelling, 'Play ball, batter up!' See the batter come to the plate, swinging the legs, the arms, then throwing all but one away and standing in the box, waiting for the pitcher to hurl the head into him. See the catcher with the torso strapped on as a chest protector, the infielders with their hand mitts, the stomach rosin bag, and all the other pieces of equipment that once was Central City's star pitcher, Herbie Satin. And in the morning, watch the faces of the fans as they pack the park and see the green grass now stained red, and see the hastily substituted pitcher step to the rubber and stare down at the stone plaque embedded there, with the engraved words memorializing the gory remains buried underneath the pitcher's mound." So the pitcher's mound now says, "Herbert Satin, pitcher, murderer, R.I.P.S. And we wrap up with, "Hehe, so that's my Yelp yarn for this issue, kiddies. Herbie the pitcher went to pieces that night and was taken out of existence, that is. The plaque turned out to be his gravestone, and the pitcher's mound his grave. Oh, by the way, next time you go to see Central City play, be careful where you sit. That night, one of Bayville's boys hit a homer into the stands. They never found the ball." So with that, we wrap up one of the most gruesome EC stories. And I really, really enjoy this one. Again, like the last one, like I was saying, there's something to it. It's not, these players are out to get vengeance, and you can feel why. This one seems like it would have been perfect for an adaptation on Tales from the Crypt, but was not ever adapted. Going to the real meat of it, illustration of the body parts, the way that Jack Davis drew this just horrific scene of intestines being like splayed out all over the place, and the Herbie's head being kind of, it's like he's got an eye hanging out, his clearly his head was bashed in, and just the various body parts that the batter swinging a what appears to be an arm, and on the catcher wearing the Herbie's chest as a chest protector. It's very gruesome, but as a credit to them, so they're this game is taking place at midnight. So rather than it being this horribly bloody scene with just intestines and whatever, it's done very simply with blue coloring the entire background, the field, the stands, and everything. And everything else, the players, the body parts, and all that, all being done in yellow, to kind of, since they're in the moonlight. So it's horrific, but it's handled in such a way where it's not so unsettling that you can't look at it. It's obviously done with care, to know that it's going to be it a lot to take in. The final panel of the story, with the showing Herbie's grave, that, like, it's the blood that's spattered all over the field, it's just kind of done in drops and half tones. It's not just this like pools of blood all over the place. It's just done in like a simple, very simple way of dropping the color here and there, so it's not too overwhelming. So I give them a lot of credit for that. For what it is, for it being this very gruesome thing, it was handled very well. I think that this is one that I'm kind of on the fence about saying that I wish that it had a little more, like another page or two to be able to flesh it out, because the Crypt Keeper's exposition in the middle of the story, or 2/3 of the way through the story, seems to just kind of come out of nowhere. The story's been progressing, and then there's just a panel that's pretty much all text, just bringing you up to speed about, you know, what Herbie's been up to and why, his motives and everything. So I wish that was handled a little better, but otherwise, I thought it was great. The art, like I said before, that, you know, you're dealing with one of the best, and everything about this was fantastic. Herbie is just this clearly an unlikable character, and the way that the team handles him is very unexpected, but is very in line with these sorts of stories. Knowing that's where the story was going to go, having seen those panels online, it still was very interesting to me to see, like, how they got there. I thought it was fantastic. That's two stories for this week. Just a really great, if you have a chance, I was able to track this down on this site called Read Comic Online. You can look it up. This had an entire scan of the issue, which was really great. A really nice scan of it. I highly recommend going and checking this out. There's also another story in this issue that was adapted for Tales from the Crypt. You know, if that is something that and you know, some people enjoy that sort of thing, I know that that was a nice way for me to get into it. The one of the stories in here, "Lover Come Hack to Me," was adapted, so that's always a fun thing that we've done in the past. Go and watch the Tales from the Crypt. A lot of those are out on YouTube right now, so watch that, read the story, see how it was updated, see how it was changed. But yeah, these two stories, highly recommend them. I know that I've just given you a synopsis of the entire thing. They still warrant a reading. Fantastic. So that'll do it for tonight. Thank you all for listening so much. You can keep up with us through Facebook and through our Twitter. It's Comics in the GA. You can keep up with us also through the Comics Podcast Network, comicspodcast.com. Send us email at comicsinthega@gmail.com. And feel free to rate and review over at iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. We always appreciate hearing from you all. So hope to talk to you soon. Have a great night.